I grew up in a place called Woodmere, Long Island, and graduated high school. And it was very clear when I graduated that I was coming to Cornell. My father was a Cornellian, was recruiting for Cornell, put two of his brothers through Cornell, and this was the school he was going to pay tuition at. So it became pretty clear where I was going. My dad was a Cornellian. He was the first college graduate in his family, and he apparently was a very good student, and he was also a very good athlete. So he had a scholarship to come to Cornell. I guess he ran cross country and track and played basketball, and fell in love with this place, so much so that when he graduated in 1922, the first thing he did was to put his two brothers through Cornell. Hal was class of 26 and Dave was class of 30. I have a sister, Audrey. Audrey also came to Cornell, class of 1958. We would drive up to Cornell as a kid, and it was a 7.5 hour trip from New York City to Ithaca. And so that my sister and I wouldn't fight, we would count the cows. And then we'd come down Route 96, just as you come over the hill. Ithaca College wasn't there then. And you'd first get a glimpse of Cayuga Lake. And all of a sudden, my dad looked 10 years younger. Walk around BB Lake, and he'd point out to me where the toboggan run was, which used to be by Baker Labs. The chemistry building wasn't there, and there was a toboggan run that ran over the road onto BB Lake. And he would talk about these silly brothers that he put through school who would go down this toboggan run on ice skates, and then they'd slide all the way down to the bridge at the far eastern end of BB Lake. He helped recruit for Cornell from the first days that I can remember. Coaches and faculty members and admissions officers would come and stay at our house, and this became the thing that gave him the most enjoyment of anything outside of his family. Dad was so heavily involved in admissions that when he died, a lot of people thought that in his memory they would contribute to a fund to furnish the waiting room in the admissions office. And there is a plaque there that honors him. Then I matriculated at Cornell in September of 1951. I applied to the Arts and Science School when I first tried to matriculate here, and then switched to architecture very early on in my career, so that I really was in the architecture school in the class of 56, not the class of 55.
Don is a class of 56 classmate, honorary, of course, but he is also the class of 57 and 55 and 58 and 68 and possibly other classes, too, that I don't even know about.
Well, Don was unusual in that he had so many interests outside of the school. He was active in on a number of activities on campus. He always seemed to be carrying his tennis bag as a member of the tennis team, or kicking a soccer ball either on the quad or in the drafting room.
Tom Mackesy was another person who just influenced me greatly. He ultimately became not just dean of the College of Architecture, Art, and Planning, but he became dean of the faculty, and was a close friend of mine. And he was the one that basically basically called me into his office one day and said, "Don, I think you're very talented, but I think you're also very competitive, and if you want to satisfy your competitive spirits and take advantage of your creativity and talent, you'd be better off being an engineer than an architect." And I respected him so much, and I loved the structures courses, and so I thought he was right. And I think that's what caused me to switch probably someplace around 1956. In 1951, when we came, there wasn't much housing. The university dorms weren't there. The girls' dorms were there, but many of the men had to live in off-campus housing. And there was a house, 102 Willard Way, which still exists now. It was an old Rothschild house, and it was a rooming house that about 16, 17 of us lived in. And that was my freshman year. My sophomore, junior years, I lived in the fraternity.
I've known Don Greenberg since the first grade, 1941. When we graduated high school, several of us came off here to Cornell, and Don was my roommate at Cornell. Donald abhors mayonnaise, and so to get his goat for whatever reason, because we were competitive even in rooming together, I would go over to him and blow on Don and said, "Here, have a bite of my mayonnaise and egg salad." And he really had a deep hatred for it. In fact, to this day, I don't think he allows Irish to keep mayonnaise in their home.
I was fortunate enough to be a member of Quill and Dagger. And in the fall of 1955, an invitation came to Cornell from the Shah of Iran to invite 10 exchange students to a camp which the Shah held every year in Babelsar, which is on the southern end of the Caspian Sea. And the administration sent this down to Quill and Dagger to see how many people might want to go, and the next day we had asked if we could have 20 spots. And so 20 of us went over to Iran, actually 21 of us, went over to Iran in the summer of 56.
Donnie was a great athlete, and of course we knew him from Quill and Dagger. He showed his athletic prowess when we were in Iran. And Donnie and I and the rest of us, or five of us at a time, played basketball on this kind of crummy court, which was sandy, as I remember it, as was everything else. Don was, of course, our leading scorer. But as I remember, I don't think we beat the other team. I think we lost the game, but Donnie was the very best of us. So was he competitive? You bet.
I think in one of the funnier things that happened during the trip is we were basically required to put together a soccer team to play a bunch of Iranians in soccer up at a camp that the Shah had established. I had never really played soccer before. Don, of course, was all Ivy, all American, all everything else. And I do recall at the end of the game, the Cornell team was holding its own very, very nicely, thank you. I got put in at the end of the game and promptly kicked the ball past Greenberg, who was a prize goalie. But he couldn't handle it. Unfortunately, we lost 1-0, I think, was the final score. He was, to the best of our knowledge, the world's oldest living undergraduate at Cornell. It was never quite certain, but I think we thought he was.
Mm-hmm. Well, I came back to Cornell in 1963, and I started to work on my PhD at Cornell after passing all of the exams to start to work on a thesis in around 1965. And so I started to teach in the architecture school as an instructor in structural concepts in 65. So while I was teaching in the architecture school, I was working on the cable structures. And simultaneously, I started teaching computer-aided design in the architecture school. And nobody was really using computers to do this. And I had the good fortune of starting to write programs to graphically display the displacements and deformations and stresses of these cable structures, because I thought spatially and I wanted to see how these things worked. And I couldn't see it without the pictures. And that's how I got into computer graphics back then. And nobody wanted to have anything to do with it at the time, but I was absolutely fascinated. I had a classmate by the name of Rod Ruggiero, class of 1955, who ran the General Electric Visual Simulations Laboratory up in Syracuse, New York. And lo and behold, he was running the lab and building hardware to train the astronauts how to dock the lunar landing vehicle with the Apollo mother spacecraft. I said, Rod, this is what I want to do. Can I come see your lab? And I drove up to Syracuse, and he showed me the lab. And very quickly, he let me have use of the lab. And within a month or so, I was working at the lab two or three nights a week from 5 in the afternoon till 8 in the morning, because GE was an 8 to 5 outfit. And we became a 5 to 8 outfit. And I'd bring up my 14 students who were working with me in design class to start to work on a movie which was made, which was Cornell in Perspective. This was around 1969 now. Me and we'd stay in that lab all night long trying to make a simulation of walking through the Cornell Quad. And that movie was probably completed 2 years later and was well publicized, but really got me on the start of looking at computer graphics from a scientific point of view for the next 35 years.
And I had Don Greenberg as professor in a number of courses, and it's where we did a landmark project where we modeled the entire Arts Quadrangle in three dimensions. We actually had to even go off campus to use a computer up in Syracuse at General Electric's facilities. And remember, we had to program the entire buildings we were doing with punch cards. And Don really was an extraordinary professor. He motivated us. He had vision. He excited us. With Don, we imagined things that we never even imagined before.
I remember one time he took out a print about the size of a postcard, put it on the coffee table that we were sharing, and he said, "What do you think this is? None of it's real. It's all simulated." Don's contribution to the profession was legendary, in the sense that he was trying to develop a system that would allow a firm of 9 people to compete with a firm of 250.
I thought I was going to stay at Cornell for 1 year after my PhD. And I guess I could segue to 2004 now. Here I am, almost 4 decades later, and I'm teaching now in the architecture school. I teach computer graphics in the computer science department. I teach computer animation in both art and computer science in a new organization called Computer and Information Science. And I teach a course of disruptive technology in the business school. You might have gone up to the plantations and see this concrete shelter, which was my avocation back in the mid-1960s. I still wanted to be a shell engineer to some degree. And I was teaching a class in shell structures and built this shelter on the plantations, which is called a hyperbolic paraboloid. And this hypar, its colloquial name around here is the flying diaper. I go by it every day almost out of superstition because I really like it on the plantations. One of my closest colleagues and certainly the person who I enjoyed teaching the most with was Alan Shimakoff. I'm particularly enamored with a course which we taught on tall buildings.
Working with Don is like working with a sometimes mystic. You get sentences that sound profound, and maybe they are, but unless you ask him what they mean or what he means when he says something that is maybe purposefully ambiguous, you'll never figure out what's on his mind. Sometimes he speaks in riddles. Sometimes he sticks his lower lip out and makes a declarative statement. And if you don't ask what's on his mind, you'll never figure it out.
I am forever indebted to what the National Science Foundation did for me. They started to support me in 1973, and I've had continuous support for 35 years. And that's just a dream world for an academic. When we started, I wrote this proposal to do research in computer graphics, and no department wanted it. The architecture department said it was too technological. And the engineering college basically said it was absolutely a waste of time for engineers to be drawing pretty pictures with a computer. And the computer science department, which was just getting started, basically said this was too applied and made no sense. So I was kind of at wit's end and didn't know what to do. And I went to then President Dale Corson. And I talked to Dale about what I was trying to do. And Dale basically said, "Don, I'll support it. If you can get the funding, we'll set it up as an interdisciplinary center, and we'll take our chance. And we'll guarantee the funding for the initial part of the equipment match that Cornell has to do." And we started it as an interdisciplinary center in 1973. The first equipment came in, I think, January 2nd, 1974. And I am forever indebted to Dale. He's my academic godfather.
My biggest interaction with Don has been in connection with his computer graphics work. He came to me in the early years when I was president of Cornell, about the early 70s sometime, to propose a operation that led to the computer graphics program that he's pursued all these years. He told me what he wanted to do, and I liked it. I was very much interested in this. It was in the direction of my ideas of bringing different disciplines to bear, and from what he and I discussed on that day when he came to present this proposition, I could just see it blossoming into a really productive way of doing architecture. And Don likes to say that I was kind and became his godfather and supported his work, what I was really doing was promoting my own ideas for how things should go. And it's just turned out to be a tremendous success.
One of the greatest things I did when I came here as a PhD student working with Don and right now as his colleague is appreciating how much Don always looked where other people have not looked before. And other great things that Don did in all of these years, he was able to really work with people, some of the best people in the industry and in academia, to build that vision together with a bunch of others. And this is really to his great credit that he was able to do this with very, very disparate people.
And one of the things I really remember about working with Don as a student was the amazing power he had to get people enthused about projects. And especially, I was at different times during my career as a student, I was working on projects where I was doing something that the rest of the group didn't know as much about and was working sort of on my own, and I would get into a state where I felt like nothing was working, everything was broken, there was no way we were ever going to solve the problem we were trying to solve. And I would come talk to Don, and I could never remember what he said, but after a few minutes talking to him, I would come out of the office sure that the project was going to succeed, and that's something I wish I could do with my students now.
And then, of course, I got to know Don as a great professor. He transcends all the conventional boundaries on campus. It's difficult to fit him into departmental or even collegiate boxes and spots. Don's a man of remarkably broad interests and sympathies. Students from generations will talk about the impact that Don Greenberg has had upon their lives. And the remarkable thing is that that influence reaches out beyond the campus into the world of industry and entrepreneurism, California and other parts of the world, as much as it focuses here in Ithaca.
I was very, very lucky in the sense that I was able to play a number of sports at Cornell. And if you've ever played on a sports team at Cornell, you realize that you have instantaneously a number of really close friends. And I went out for the tennis team in the fall of my freshman year, and in my junior year, I had a close friend by the name of Shorty Preschel, who was an All-American soccer player. And he suggested that I try and go out and see if I could play goalie on the soccer team. And I did and fell in love with the sport. I'd never played it in high school. I needed some sport which was rougher than tennis because they wouldn't let me go out for football because they, I had had two broken legs when I was in high school when a mail truck hit me riding on the handlebars of my bike. And they didn't think that I would ever be able to hold up on a contact sport. Ended up having 3 years of soccer. I wanted to play basketball, but there was a couple of people, particularly Chuck Rolls, who was in front of me, and there was no way I was going to be able to make that team. They were sending me over to Europe to train with the U.S. Olympic soccer team for 2 years, and that was for the 1960 Olympics in Rome, and my first tour of duty was 8 weeks of soccer training at Floyd Bennett Field up in Long Island. I played tennis for the United Services in the Army, Navy, Air Force, all through Europe. Had a chance to travel playing with both teams all over the European continent, and would fly all over Europe playing sports. And when I'd write Iris about it, she said that she was going to write her congressperson. So I don't think they were heroic parts of military service.
He played sports in the Army. In fact, when he was stationed in Germany And he would tell me the captain had sent a helicopter to pick him up so that he would play tennis with the captain. This happened a couple of times, and finally I said to him, I'm not paying my income taxes anymore. And he said, why not? I said, I am not supporting your vacation on my measly salary.
You know I love to play sports, and I guess my body's held out. And so I've tried to keep active every day. Finally gave up soccer about 20 years ago. I guess I was afraid my legs would be hurt, but I continued playing basketball and tennis. And one of the great things about the Senior Olympics and tennis competition in the United States now is you can't wait until you have your next five-year birthday. And, you know, this is the year I'm 70 years old, so I'm the young kid on the block, and I can play in the 70s. And, it really doesn't mean that much. You still lose to the same guys you used to lose to in high school, but I'll play in the national grass and probably the national hard court tournaments in tennis this year. I represent the East. Last month I played in the teams qualifying for the national tournaments in both tennis and basketball, and won both the singles in the men's 70 in tennis, and played on the winning basketball team. And at college, I have the luxury of playing with the tennis team, and whenever I can go out at lunchtime and play basketball with a group of old men who want to keep running around, I love to do it. And then I don't fight with my wife. I'm pleasing with my students. I have got all of my energies or all of my competitive nature gone, and I can be a nice guy, I hope. And it kind of works.
I consider Don one of the greatest friends of Cornell Athletics. Not only was he a terrific athlete himself, playing tennis and soccer and other sports, he's been a terrific help to our men's tennis program, always looking out for both the athletes and the coaching staff.
When he comes in, he'll ask, you know, if he has any eligibility left so we can get him out there for one last semester of competitive collegiate tennis.
I love tennis. I played tennis all my life. I wish I could play tennis half as well as Don Greenberg can.
Bought a piece of property in 1986, I think, that was owned by J.O. Mahoney, who was a professor of art at Cornell University, and it's the guy that painted the Green Dragon. And I had been to parties at his home when I was an undergraduate. And it's a site which is on a gorge looking over Cayuga Lake, and it's got a waterfall. It's about 80 feet, and you can't see another house, and it's wonderful. And
I remember visiting that site as a student when J.O. Mahoney lived there, and just being blown away by the beauty of the views to Lake Cayuga, to downtown Ithaca, to the hills beyond.
Don loves Cornell. He has a relationship with Cornell that is not logical. I think it's an emotional relationship. It's been part of his life. I think he can remember starting at 3 years old coming to Ithaca. And every time an opportunity arose for us to possibly go elsewhere, we would have these rational discussions about why it might be advantageous to go elsewhere. And when it came down to the bottom line, he couldn't leave. He absolutely couldn't leave.
I just love living in that place. I will never leave Ithaca, New York. That's they're going to have to carry me out. I remember much later on, after I had built the house, when my friend Otto had come in to see it, the first thing he said to me with tears in his eyes was, "Boy, Hank would really have liked this place."
Not only were we good friends when we were here, we've continued to be good friends. And I keep trying to get him out of Ithaca, but he won't leave.
He is the idea man. He has the concepts. He sees far ahead.
I've been privileged to count him as a friend.
He really is a lovable person, and you won't find a better friend than Don.
How is it possible not to love that guy?
He's a legend here.